You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer.
Okay, I see what it is. Okay.
Hey, listeners, you just missed the pre-show talk where Fred said na-na-na-na-na because somebody thinks he's right about something, but we don't. It's today, Tuesday, December 9th.
Keep the challenge alive.
And I'm going to start off with some listener feedback. Got some good listener feedback from the last episode. And I'm going to quote, it says, "Michael just opened my eyes to the obvious. Auto emergency braking cost automakers and sales of replacement vehicles. Head exploding emoji. Been staring at us in the face. Of course, as always, the rich can pay for premium safety features." Thank you, listeners. And, you know, that's why you should donate and support a show like this. Go to autosafety.org. Click on donate. How's that for starting a show?
It's not bad. You know, that was, I thought I was being fairly cynical when I pointed that out because, you know, I don't know that there is some bean counter sitting around in an auto company saying, "Hey, if we put all this automatic emergency braking into our cars, we're going to sell, you know, one third fewer vehicles or whatever it is next year." So AEB is an industry killer. You know, I don't know that. I'm sure someone has thought about that, though. I just, you know, who knows?
I don't know.
But it certainly raises a question, you know, when the auto industry is so opposed and trying to roll back an AEB standard that is, you know, still not a perfect AEB standard and kind of gave the industry some breaks because the technology is, you know, 20 years old and not 40, and totally mature. You know, I think we're with the NHTSA rule. I think we've talked about this in term of grade school before, how the original agreement with the Alliance and other safety partners and NHTSA was, you know, for 25 mile per hour. So automatic emergency braking, which is, you know, kindergarten level, because it really doesn't even reach the speeds that are most injurious or fatal in crashes. And the NHTSA rule, you know, really pegged up that speed to, you know, highway speeds and areas where, you know, we think automatic emergency braking needs to be effective to have an impact on safety. And the industry has come out in opposition to that rule and is trying to roll it back, suggesting that they want to go back to, you know, a lower standard and for less effective automatic emergency braking. I mean, I think what primarily is behind that is they're trying to challenge NHTSA's assertion that they need to, you know, basically come out perfect on their pedestrian AEB test. You know, getting 4 out of 6 right doesn't really work out well in practice when you're on a real road with real people, and they need to be able to prove in a test environment, particularly when they're designing the AEB to beat these tests, that they can do it right. And so, you know, there's a lot of problems there.
I need to jump in because we have to remind people that there are companies, certainly at least one company, that already provide automatic emergency braking that complies with NHTSA's proposed standard.
So right. Toyota.
So the idea that it has to be rolled back somehow to protect industry is pure bullshit.
Yeah, and Toyota's been doing it since at least 2023. I mean, at least one of the vehicles that NHTSA tested under their new protocols passed with flying colors. So we know it can be done. And it was not a Lexus or some luxury Toyota. It was a Corolla or a Camry or, you know, one of the base model Toyotas that they're selling to everyone out there. And it has good automatic emergency braking. Somehow the industry doesn't believe that as a whole they can reach that standard, and we strongly disagree.
All right. Well, with that, let's jump right into this week's news, and we'll focus on people who are not putting the wool over our eyes, not talking nonsense. Good, hard American workers. That's right. We're starting with President Trump and Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy. They unveil the new Freedom Means Affordable Cars. And it's going to reset fuel economy standards because, you know, more affordable cars, more asthma for all. Come on, yeah. Mike, you're shaking your head. And this is your gaslight. I mean, come on. Let's just jump right into
this. This is a bad one. In fact, this isn't my gaslight. My gaslights are related to it, though. And okay. It's something that Trump and Duffy discussed. That was a separate issue regarding small cars that they I don't think they had any idea of what they're talking about here. I'm still not sure that either one of them knows what they're talking about, because what they're doing is essentially saying, we're going to cut fuel economy requirements down to where, you know, by, I think it's 2031 or something, instead of, you know, the average vehicle getting somewhere around 50 miles per gallon, they're going to be getting, you know, I think 34.5 miles per gallon.
Yes.
So it's a huge cut in what automakers need to do. Not only that, they've already, you know, effectively destroyed the civil penalty system that makes manufacturers actually reach those goals. So we're still uncertain, you know, how you're going to get them to meet the 34.5 mile per gallon goal by 2031 if there are no civil penalties forcing them to do that.
Well, then this is my gaslight if it's not your gaslight.
Yeah, and I sent it to you a minute ago because I wanted you to focus on, you know, one of these big deals here.
See, I got confused what your gaslight is. I think my gaslight I chose is what your gaslight's going to be.
They're so taking Michael, this NHTSA study, right? They're taking this NHTSA study that was done in the I think in the Biden administration to show what, it's an economic analysis essentially that NHTSA is doing to show how much vehicle costs are going to decline if automakers pass along, right? If automakers pass along these savings to their customers, that's a question mark there. But they're saying that if they do, the average person's going to save about $930 on a car. I mean, when I first heard that, I was like, okay, you're saving, 2% on the value of a vehicle when you buy a new one, now that vehicles are, on average, $50,000, you know, to purchase a vehicle. Not a great discount. And not only that, when the auto industry is only building vehicles that can average out at 34.5 miles per gallon, I believe is the number, versus 50 miles per gallon, what does that mean? It means we're all going to be buying a hell of a lot more gas. And so, you know, the NHTSA economic analysis said that we would be raising fuel consumption by 100 billion gallons through 2050, which is going to cost Americans up to $185 billion. So cutting to the quick here, Americans are being, you know, gaslit in large terms here. They're saying we're going to save you essentially $1,000 here, maybe, if the manufacturers pass that money along. Is that going to happen? I don't know. Every manufacturer is probably going to be different, but I'm skeptical of that. What we do know, and what is hard to deny, is that fuel consumption is going to go through the roof because cars aren't going to be as efficient. And so ultimately here, this action, not only is it going to increase the rate of potential global warming, increase emissions, it's also going to significantly increase Americans' gas bill and destroy any chance of a discount that they're hyping here. So, you know, it's bullshit. There's no other better way to put it.
No, you've just laid out the perfect argument, Michael, for us to invade Venezuela, because then we can get their oil and keep prices low at the pump. USA, USA, USA. Okay, Fred, voice of sanity.
I was just going to say, any association between Trump's recent business activity in Saudi Arabia and a promise to raise the consumption of oil is certainly chimerical, and that would never happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. All right, Michael, you did great on doing my gaslight. I mean, nice. I'm in the lead right now. I'm loving this, because I got to sit back and I didn't have to do anything. Let's get into your real gaslight with what Grandpa Puddin'Brains thinks about small cars.
So there was an odd exchange, between Trump and Duffy, as, you know, they're basically admiring these really small cars in Asia. You know, Trump's saying, you know, I went to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and they have this really small car, you know, that could be really efficient. Why aren't we building those here? Why can't we do that here?
Let me slow you down. What his quote actually is: they're very small, they're really cute. I saw them getting dressed backstage at the beauty pageant. They were, oh my God, that bumper on that one.
Yeah, and they're saying, you know, essentially, Trump and Duffy are both alluding to the fact that there's somehow a prohibition on these cars being built in America. That couldn't be further from the truth. There is no prohibition on building those small cars. If you outfit them to meet federal motor vehicle safety standards, they can be built here. The problem is they won't sell in America, and Americans have been buying increasingly larger vehicles for 2 to 3 decades now. And little cars have, you know, which used to represent a significant portion of the market, have now dwindled, and the companies don't offer them anymore because they can't make a huge profit on them. But they are, you know, ultimately, if our roads were populated by much smaller vehicles, we'd be winning at fuel economy. We'd be winning at safety because we wouldn't have, you know, massive pickups and SUVs involved in crashes generating, you know, a lot of kinetic energy. So it's, you know, they're essentially setting up a straw man here and saying, you know, oh, the federal government is prohibiting these vehicles from being built and being bought in America. There is no such prohibition. I mean, that's completely false. And that is, you know, about as big of a gaslight as you're going to get when someone's pretending things are, you know, not the way they actually are. So I was disappointed that Duffy got sucked into that. You know, it's one of those things where previous transportation secretaries, you know, might have stepped back and you know, nodded to the person that is in charge of one of their agencies and let them take over because they might actually know what they're talking about. Clearly, Duffy and Trump here had no clue what they were talking about.
Well, they're going to sell more small cars, and they're going to be putting them in airports next to the chin-up bars that that Duffy's installing too. To, you know, it'll help you lift out. Like, you're done with chin-ups, you can lift your Ford Fiesta.
Yeah,
that's my thinking. Now, Fred, we're going to get to your gaslight. Before we get to that, what is so? I could you know, be on the border of being an expert in whatever the hell it is I do for a living, something related to computers and software. But at the same time, I stare at a computer screen all day long. So I don't know how this thing works. I've never taken one apart, but I stare at it all day long. So I assume expertise in this. What kind of mental condition is this called, Fred?
Magic.
Oh, no. Oh, the magical thinking. I have suffered from magical thinking. Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well,
you're not qualified to tear down the East Wing of the White House.
Perfect. I need more asbestos in my diet. And with that, Fred, I'm going to use that as the lead-in to your gaslight, which is as cute as a small Malaysian car.
It is. Well, I'm tired of losing the gaslight competition, so I'm going in with a four-dimensional gaslight.
Oh, boy.
And you guys who are doing the one-dimensional gaslights, you're just going to have to stand by and admire. So there was an article in New York Times last week.
Never heard of it.
This week. And it was an op-ed, and the title of the op-ed is "The Data on Self-Driving Cars is Clear. We Have to Change Course," which I agree with, but the course I would pick is different than the one the gentleman picked. He's a Dr. Slotkin. He's a neurosurgeon. And complicit, all the dimensions are from Waymo, the New York Times itself, and some chimerical peer group that's out there somewhere. So the New York Times made much of the website at Waymo that said there were dramatic reductions, like 92% in all kinds of collisions, based upon a peer-reviewed article. The title of that article is, if you dig enough through the Waymo website, you can find it. Do autonomous vehicles outperform latest generation human-driven vehicles? A comparison to Waymo's auto liability insurance claims at 25 million miles. A couple of interesting things about this. First is they neglect the other 75 million miles that Waymo claims to have driven. So clearly not the latest generation information they've got. On their website, they say that, quoting now, when excluding ADS crashes with a delta V less than 1 mile per hour, about half of the ADS collisions were excluded, resulting in comparisons that showed a large statistically significant reduction in all comparisons, except for one comparison from San Francisco. But if you actually read the study, and I don't believe that anybody reporting on it has, it excludes 100% of all the collisions reported to the NHTSA through the standard general order, stating general order. So that means that whatever conclusions they derive from their data is completely detached from the collisions they're actually reporting to the federal government. So that's an interesting structure for a paper that's talking about safety. And also published on their website, quoting from it, as we accumulate more mileage, it will become possible to make statistically significant conclusions on other subsets of data, paren, for example, fatal crashes as its own category, close paren. So that's a quote. Now, taking that quote apart, it says it's not now possible to make that correlation because it will become possible in the future to talk about that kind of significant problem. And the other thing that is implied by this is that any claims for safety related to fatal crashes are not supportable by the data because they simply don't have enough information. So in looking at their conclusions, which they don't explicitly say, you can't draw any conclusions about the actual safety of these vehicles relative to fatal crashes or fatal, you know, fatal consequences of any crash. You look at it a little bit further and it says the Waymo safety report was last published in 2021. That's 4 years ago, right? That's kind of a world apart from software. And it's also true that they were using a completely different version of the software and the vehicles in 2021. So what they've reported basically has got nothing to do with what they're doing now. Different hardware, different software, different environment, different streets. So even going back to the article that is the basis for all this, it says, do autonomous vehicles outperform latest generation human-driven vehicles? A comparison to Waymo's own auto liability insurance claims at 25 million miles. Well, okay, what about the other 75 million miles? They don't not relevant? And they also say, and they slip this in here, a comparison to Waymo's auto liability insurance claims. So that's the basis of this study. Now, if you live in a hurricane-prone area, are building codes based upon the number of insurance claims that have been filed? Or building codes based upon the actual data associated with a hurricane, like maximum wind speed and frequency and that sort of stuff. And I think you're going to recognize that it's not really based upon the number of insurance claims or the number of claims sustained. It's based upon hard data about how the system's actually working. So this Waymo study, on which they're basing all of these pretty outrageous claims, isn't really even related to the operational data of the vehicles, except through a long distant chain that travels through several insurance companies and legal claims of liability. Now, a legal claim and legal process is a really lousy way of getting the data that you want to organize an engineering response to a hazard. So again, it's a complete, what they've done is completely neglected all of the NHTSA SGO data and 3/4 of the miles driven by their vehicles, and all later, or now current, software and hardware versions now installed in Waymo cars. But it's peer-reviewed, says New York Times. Well, so who are the peers? They're not identified. Peer group is not identified. The authors of this article are all either Waymo employees or Waymo clients. So this suggests a bit of a bias.
Well, Fred, the author of this op-ed, though, he's a neurosurgeon. I mean, he's saying this saves lives. How dare, what is your background in neuro? Wait a second.
Well, I appreciate his sentiment. He says, you know, that car crashes are really ugly and we need to do something to reduce them. But the idea that Waymos are going to be a silver bullet that's going to solve that problem is just ridiculous.
But come on, clearly he must have a background in auto safety and statistics and things of this nature if he's making such bold claims, because if not, I know exactly how my computer monitor works.
Yeah, but and that's all good. But he is an investor. He is part of an investment group. And clearly, he's done his homework because he's a smart investor and he's a smart neurosurgeon. Now, how that relates to auto safety, I'm not completely sure. But I'm drawing four conclusions out of this that justify my bullshit claims, or my claims of bullshit, or gaslight, or whatever it is we're claiming here. Number one, the New York Times makes much of the peer-reviewed nature of the article, but they don't identify the peers and only identify Waymo employees and clients. So it seems to me the reporter doesn't disclose...
Not a reporter, is an opinion piece.
...rationale for analytic independence by these conclusions that they're publishing without question. They claim the evidentiary basis can be, well, the claims basis can be easily skewed if Waymo just decides to pay the claims themselves rather than go through the insurance industry, right? So everything is based on insurance claims. But there's, since this is completely disassociated from the actual reported collisions through the SGO, what does this really mean? And why are the data useful? And who are these peers? What else I've got here? Assuming the Neurosurgeons Investment Group, Dr. Slotkin's investment group, is not aligned with Google or Waymo, and we don't know if that's true, but we'll make that assumption. Dr. Slotkin's credentials, sentiments, and ignorance have been unfairly exploited by Waymo. Waymo's exploited other sympathetic groups in the past. The blind, the people with mobility problems, all those communities that are going to be solved by the magic of Waymo. Now, it's not the first time Waymo's done that. And I think it's really unfair to Dr. Slotkin to take advantage of his ignorance to exploit his credentials and sympathetic call for traffic safety in this manner to develop their own IPO and their own financial future. So, Waymo's claims are a stretch. Shame on New York Times for not reporting, along with the claims that the peer review they cited for their gullibility was by Waymo and those clients and its clients, and that it neglected 100% of the available collision data through the standard general order, which currently includes less than half of the currently accumulated Waymo driving miles, based on different vehicles and different software versions. Nobody knows except Waymo what the real story is, and they're not talking. So in summary, I would advise the doctor to try to get a second opinion. Ooh, that's my gaslight.
That's pretty good. So right now, Waymos are operating at in an unrestricted ODD, operating typically under 30 miles per hour. Is that correct?
I think it's more. I think they've increased that to significantly, and now they are operating on interstates in some circumstances.
Right, so. but what the data that they're citing is for restricted ODD, typically at city speed limits, which is 30 miles per hour and under.
Yeah,
and so car crash is happening at that. How often does a victim of a car crash, a low speed crash, move out of the ER and go to a neurosurgeon? That's kind of what I'm wondering.
It's hard to say. I mean, anything can happen, particularly if someone's not wearing a seatbelt or something like that. I mean, if you have a 30 mile per hour vehicle hitting a head on another 30 mile per hour vehicle, that's a significant crash, right? So it's really hard to say. And, you know, I sympathize with his basic point, which is that, yes, if these cars were operating perfectly and very safely, or at least they're not going to be perfect, but at least, you know, far more safely, not just than the worst humans, but then, you know, even the good drivers, then yeah, if we can scale them and get them to consumers at prices that make sense, this could all work out. But there's a lot of ifs in there. And frankly, the technology that could do a lot of the safety that driverless cars put into play, you know, speed limits in cars could be enforced by much cheaper technology that we already have. Intelligent speed assistance that actually prevents cars from speeding would be a great start there. You know, alcohol detection and, you know, driver monitoring. When you put all those things into play, then I think you could see the reductions for far cheaper, far quicker than we're going to see, you know, every American in the United States adopt these expensive autonomous vehicles. I don't even think it's a, I don't think there's even a comparison there as to how much faster you can penetrate the entire US fleet. If you're standardizing safety equipment and putting it in non-autonomous vehicles while we wait for that big bright future that these companies keep promising us, that's not going to happen in 10 years, not going to happen in 20 years, maybe 50 when, you know, everyone on this podcast is long gone, except Anthony, who might be drinking green tea in Japan somewhere.
All right. Well, the other thing that is interestingly neglected is that Waymo's objective is to kill the taxi industry. Nobody has ever shown that a Waymo is any safer than a professional driver who happens to be a taxi driver. So if you were replacing taxi drivers with Waymos, you must also show that the Waymos are significantly safer than the professional drivers that you're replacing. Otherwise, you know, you're just putting people out of work for no good reason.
And also, you know, it's, I think we should definitely say here that Waymo is doing this better than anybody else out there, right?
they are in terms of sharing some data, but it's not as good.
These statements about autonomous vehicles are the future. I want to say, look, there's really only one company that is really, you know, doing this in some way that isn't just absurd at this point. You know, I think we, if you've listened to us enough,
look, Michael's getting a little too worked up while he readjusts his core. Just make sure you've clicked like and subscribe.
If you've listened to us enough, you know what we think about Tesla's. I don't even know what to call it now. If it's a robo-taxi, if it's an RC car, you know, they just don't give us enough information about the background operations for us to know whether this is a vehicle that's being controlled by a computer or by a human sitting behind a screen with a steering wheel and an accelerator and brake pedal. So, you know, Waymo has done this slowly and carefully. And although they've made some pretty outrageous predictions about the time frame in which they're going to accomplish all this, you know, for all intents and purposes, we haven't seen, you know, carnage or a level of, you know, problems on the roads. You know, we've seen a lot of things. We've seen dead dogs and cats and school bus problems that we'll probably talk about later in the podcast and other things, but nothing, you know, they're not, you know, they're not doing as bad as your average drunk driver on the road, right? And I think that's an easy comparison for them to make. And that's why they're constantly comparing themselves to the human statistics, because the human statistics include the very worst drivers and, frankly, people that shouldn't be allowed to operate vehicles on our roads anymore. And that's a failure of our states and of, you know, the feds to some extent to get those folks off the road. And to, you know, we need better punishments for people who are driving drunk. We need a more focus on, you know, making sure that drivers are up to speed and that their skills don't deteriorate over the time and that their skills are good enough when they're first getting their license and that they're trained properly. That's a system that is, frankly, I think, broken in America. And we're just letting essentially anyone who wants to get a license out on the road without any consideration of their training, of their issues that they face in their life, and a lot of things. So, you know, it's a long, long road for me for Waymo to be able to prove that, you know, their operations are actually comparable to a, you know, a great human driver.
Oh, well, Michael, just not to be the pain in the ass that I inherently am, but to say that the Waymo is way better than a drunk driver, I've never seen a test that proves that.
Yeah.
I've seen aspirational claims that, of course, it's got to be because a computer is better than a drunk. But no data that I've seen supports that. And I'd really like to see that. And
I don't even know if we can get that data because there are so many millions of Americans who are out there driving drunk every day and not being involved in crashes or serious collisions and who we'll never find out about. So I guess I'm wondering if it's a comparison that can even be made.
I've got my doubts, but I know that it has not been made in a convincing way.
Well, the takeaway from this is don't believe neurosurgeons when they step outside of their lane and say claim expertise in something they have no experience with, especially when they get funding. Well, you know, from, you know,
yeah, there's no proof of that. You know, just
I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything.
He's involved in a private
that equity he's group. A private equity guy. Yeah, he's doing health research.
The guy has never talked to Waymo in his life, even though this looks like a plant, right?
This is a Waymo PR piece. Waymo's PR is the winner of this week's Gaslight. But no, between who won this week's Gaslight, I mean, Fred, you had the good topic, but Michael wins because he did my Gaslight for me. I mean, that's,
come on, Anthony, that's how so that unfair. Works.
Hey, look, that's how it goes. But let's continue with Waymo.
Right, did my Gaslight that I did for you win, or did my Gaslight win?
Well, which will make you happier?
Neither.
Okay. Great. So let's go. Waymos and school buses in Texas. Oh, my. So the Austin Independent School District, their general counsel, has been writing letters to the general counsel for Waymo saying, hey, guys, and this is actually great. I love this letter because it's pretty casual. And it's Mari and Jeff, not dear sirs. No, Mr. Mrs. Davidson and Mr. Claire or anything like that. It's first names. And it talks about saying, hey, since our email communications a couple weeks ago, we pointed out a bunch of violations your Waymo vehicles are doing. Now there's a total of 19 different instances of Waymos illegally and dangerously passing Austin Independent School District school buses in violation of Texas law. Alarmingly, five of these violations occurred after Waymo's November 5th, 2025 letter reassuring us that certain software updates were in place to resolve the issues. So basically, the Austin School District says, hey, Waymos, our school buses stop. They put out that little arm with that flashing stop sign, which is the law in most states, I think, that vehicles behind it, you have to stop. I remember as a kid, you know, and it doesn't matter. But you have to stop there. And so the school district points us out to Waymo. Waymo says, don't worry, we fixed it over the air, man. It's magic. And then Austin comes back and says, yo, we caught you five more times just doing this. Your magic software fix is bullshit. I don't believe Waymo has responded to this yet.
I think they did respond, didn't they?
They did respond to this letter? Oh, I don't know.
They're actually filing a recall on this. But, you know, it's unclear. The recall filing hasn't come in yet to NHTSA, so we haven't seen it. But apparently, you know, this is going to be, I guess, I think that the recall software that they will be installing, I think, will be their third attempt at fixing this problem. So it really raises a lot of questions. I'm not sure if they're operating I'm not sure how much of their AI stack is operating here. Are they trying to retrain these vehicles to recognize school buses and that's taking time? Are there, who knows? They're not telling us, so we have no clue. But it's very concerning that it's very similar to my feelings on Tesla's hitting emergency crews on the side of the highway. Like, if you can't recognize these big, bright light safety hazards, how are you going to recognize the small ones? And it just gives me a lot of concern.
I agree, especially it's a stop sign that extends from the bus. It's not like it's some obscure sign that they have no training data for. It is literally a stop sign.
And not only that, it's a freaking school bus, right? It's huge and it's yellow and you can't miss it.
And it's got big red flashing meatballs all over the place.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure of the color of the Austin school buses.
But this is happening in Atlanta now, too. So Atlanta has noticed this problem with the Waymo's operating there. And they are, I don't believe they've at least not publicly drafted anything to Waymo, but they have told their school bus drivers to look out for Waymo vehicles. So
really?
We'll see where this goes.
Well, they've also asked Waymo to stop operating during school hours where they're letting passengers in and out. And Waymo has not agreed to do that.
Yeah, so, I mean, Waymo basically said, screw you, look at our safety data, which is
our safety data,
which we've just spent a lot of time talking about. So
we've eliminated 75 million miles from our data, but pick and choose whatever you got. Waymo's, their chief safety officer, their response to this has been, we will continue analyzing our vehicle's performance and making necessary fixes as part of our commitment to continuous improvement. Which is, their PR, again, Waymo's PR is Orwellian to the next degree. It's Orwellian with a smile. Three cheers to Waymo's PR. All right. Let's, what do we got next
here? And giving them their due, they do have great PR people. There's no doubt.
Do without a doubt. I'm going to, let's jump into some, let's just do it. Let's just look, trigger warning, folks, Tesla. Okay. Elon is an idiot. I say that without hesitation or reservation. From an article in Electric, Elon Musk has confirmed that Tesla's full self-driving supervised system now allows drivers to text and drive, though he added a caveat that it depends on the context of surrounding traffic. Listeners, that you should read that as if there's traffic, or if there's a road, or if you're in a vehicle, don't text and drive. No, this does not absolve you of any legal ramifications that will come from this. This is dumb. This is still level two nonsense.
I mean, if you haven't started ignoring Elon by now, you probably should, especially when he's telling you how you should be driving. I mean, this is just the next, this is a problematic for a lot of reasons. Essentially, you know, he's claiming that you can use Tesla's full self-driving and text and drive, even though it's illegal in 49 states plus DC and the territories. Montana, by the way, is, I think, the only place where it's not illegal to text and drive. You know, what the hell are they doing? It's, you know, I can't emphasize enough, and I doubt there are a lot of Tesla fanboys listening to us right now, but do not text and drive. I mean, we know that you have to keep an eye on Tesla, whether it's, you know, their autopilot, full self-driving, whatever automated Tesla system is engaged. You've got to keep your eyes on the road, and you certainly, like, don't need to be taking your mind off the entire, you know, thing. You know, hands off, eyes off, and brain off are not a good way to be operating a vehicle at all. Even a vehicle that has been, you know, promising you autonomy for 10 years and failed. It's a terrible idea. And I just wonder what state's attorney generals think about, you know, a company that is essentially designing and promoting a technology intended to help people break the law, right? I mean, I don't think that that most state statutes involving criminal conspiracies extend to traffic violations. But, you know, essentially here, you're creating a massive criminal conspiracy to violate texting and driving laws across America promoted by the CEO of a large company. It's incredibly odd, and it's something that, you know, another thing that I don't see any traditional automotive leader advising their customers to do, because I think there could be some significant blowback from it. And, you know, Elon will just file more lawsuits and get on Twitter and yell about it. But it's, you know, it's a terrible idea to even propose to people who aren't monitoring full self-driving or their, you know, whatever automation they're using, to just propose to them that, you know, they're going to be safe soon to text and drive in their cars is the height of stupidity.
Yeah. Listeners, don't text, don't allow your friends to text and drive. And like, I do this all the time whenever I'm watching The Real Housewives of Mormonism or whatever the name of that show is. And they're always texting and driving and FaceTiming and driving. I yell at the TV and you stop it. It's not what your show should be about. Okay. Let's go to my favorite topic of all time, GM Cruise. How's this sound? Oh, yeah. There's a website called GMAuthority.com. I love it. And these guys sat down and did the math on how much General Motors has spent on their GM Cruise. Remember GM Cruise? Of course you do, listeners. And they went through all of it. And $12.1 billion General Motors set on fire to create GM Cruise for a kid named Kyle. Like, the Make-A-Wish Foundation has just really gotten out of hand. I mean, that's the only way I can look at this. Like, this is absurd.
You know, I really noticed this in the context of, you know, last week's gaslights and the announcement of that Senate hearing come up in January around the, you know, the cost of safety equipment going on into cars. And, you know, the assertion by certain, you know, conflicted or misguided senators that safety equipment is driving up prices for consumers versus a million other factors that, you know, we don't have any control over, at least consumers don't. And if you look at, you know, just this article, Cruise has spent, you know, GM has spent $12.1 billion on a, you know, essentially a failed autonomous vehicle company. And meanwhile, you know, when they were coming out in opposition to the automatic emergency braking rule earlier this year, the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, you know, proudly proclaimed that automakers had spent $1 billion on automatic emergency braking, which, you know, pales in comparison to what one company has spent on autonomous vehicles that, you know, haven't arrived and won't arrive in any substantial form for 50 years. Meanwhile, they're trying to get automatic emergency braking, which is here and could be rolling out to every vehicle. You know, it's just nonsense that we're having to actually listen to CEOs go to the Senate and claim that safety equipment is driving up their prices when they are burning money and passing those costs down to consumers on autonomy that doesn't even work yet and won't work for decades. So that's the real reason I wanted to point that article out, just to point out just the bald hypocrisy that's taking place in the industry as they try to make us all think that we're going to be saved by autonomous vehicles in the next 10 years. Meanwhile, the actual safety equipment that can be going into cars that's available and that's cheap is being held up by those same automakers.
I imagine that amount of money is, you know, maybe the same amount that the Chinese have put into developing their EV systems that CEO of Ford thinks says is his favorite car. I'm like, $12.1 billion. You can design good things with that.
You know, another perspective on that $12 billion, it's about enough to pay the tuition for 1 million students in state universities for a year.
For only 1 year? That's
it. For 1 year. But still, it's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. I mean, I could spend it in a weekend.
If anybody wants to hire me to squander half that, I'm available.
I'll do it for less. I'll squander your money for less.
Don't chase me to the bottom.
$1 billion. All right, Fred, let's do the latest update on the CDVO checklist.
Computer-driven vehicles checklist for regulators. Again, when I say applicant, that means the company that's approaching you to get permission to use its self-driving vehicles on your public highways. So number 17, has the applicant proven the safety of occupants and other road users in the event of a loss of external communications or connectivity, particularly with regard to notification and controlled response to emergency ODD restrictions? It's a mouthful. What does that mean?
This is an important one because this just happened to Porsche owners in Russia, where their vehicles lost connectivity to the mothership and none of their cars would work. Well,
it's kind of a separate thing. You know, they wouldn't drive.
Well, they wouldn't drive. Right. I mean, I think it was GM Cruise or Waymo that ran into this problem in San Francisco where there's too much traffic on the cell network and they all just parked in the middle of the street.
Yeah, and I think here we're more concerned about, you know, power outages, natural disasters, whatever it is, you know, dead zones where... Well,
you've got a 5-alarm fire downtown.
Yeah.
And you've got a couple of blocks that are blocked off so that people can't interfere with the fire response. And how do you communicate that to all the Waymos scooting around town? Well, you need to use a cellular communication network to do that. There's no other way. If that network goes down, the cars aren't going to know that the roads and highways are blocked off purposefully. So it's going to create a mess as a minimum.
And not only that, like if any remote operations, which we know are taking place around all these vehicles, would be impacted. So,
right. And no, this is not just the Waymos. This is computer-driven vehicles writ large, which some people call level 2, some people call level 3, some people would call level 4, but they've all got the same characteristic, that they've given over operational control of the vehicle to a computer that needs to have situational awareness of where and when it's allowed to drive.
So we're, because the main thing here is that this is a computer driving and it requires network connectivity to know where it is and where it's going. Whereas if we're driving in our cars and your Google Maps goes down, you're still driving in the car and you still know where you are. If you're a pilot, autopilot fails, you're still highly trained to fly the vehicle. If you're on an aircraft carrier, they're all trained how to use a sextant still. And Fred, this might sound crazy, but somebody told me this the other day that in missile systems that they would have a backup sextant system if they lost communication. Is that true?
They have what's called a star tracker in general, depending on the missile, but they have a star tracker and they have the ability of seeing where the Earth limb is, which is being the edge between the atmosphere and space. So given those and knowing what time it is, they can identify where they are in space if they've lost direct communications to fire control. So, but you know, that's not every missile. There's just some missiles.
Sure. But as far as we know right now with AV systems, that there's none that has any sort of backup or redundancy that is separate from cellular networks.
I don't know that to be the case. I suspect it is the case because you can have high quality inertial navigation systems compared to a map that give you a pretty good idea what where you are. So submarines use when they're under the ice, for example. Even though they don't have direct view, they still have a pretty good idea where they are. But that requires a guidance system that costs $1 zillion.
Right. But, you know, there's other ways to do it. And okay, sorry, I didn't mean to hijack you. But hey, if you own a Porsche and you live in Russia, you have enough money to leave. What are you doing? All right.
Next up, has the applicant shown that the computer-driven vehicle operation would not replicate dangerous, injurious, or lethal circumstances for which prior use or other known prior computer-driven vehicle control system, software, perception, or physical configuration have been a factor, right? So if a self-driving vehicle has killed somebody in the past, the manufacturer should verify that it can do it in the future. That's what this is all about. And I don't think that people are doing that now, right? I know that there are circumstances where people have lost their lives in Waymos, not in Waymos, but in Teslas, in grievously injured in crews. I don't know what the injury statistics are in Waymo. They don't really reveal them. But in any case, if you know what one happened, if you know that a vehicle previously crashed into a trailer truck crossing a highway, you should make damn sure that the one that's applying to be operated on your roads doesn't have that same fault. Next up, has the applicant shown that safe disposition of the subject computer-driven vehicle in the event of loss of data processing capability or electronic sensors? So if your computer fails, you kill the occupants or you kill the pedestrians around you, or is it somehow going to safely shut down? People simplistically say, well, we'll go into an MRC and everything will be fine. Well, that's not necessarily the case. And you should have to have the applicant really demonstrate what happens and that they have a full understanding of that fault and the critical failures associated with that fault.
And we've run into that with recalls where cars will lose motive power at highway speed.
Sure.
So, and that's, again, you have a human on board who can at least hit the hazard lights and make some sort of corrective action versus you're a passenger in a Waymo. You've got nothing.
Right. You're asleep in the back of the Waymo eating, or, you know, you've just eaten a piece of apple pie.
I'm sleepy.
All of a sudden the computer goes out. What happens?
Spill my apple pie everywhere.
And it occurs when you happen to be approaching a
school bus
train of 5-year-olds crossing the street, going on a field trip from the daycare to the zoo. You know, these things happen. Next up, has the applicant shown that expedited emergency egress on demand is enabled, including in the event of loss of electrical power? So can people get the hell out of the car when they want to, whenever they feel like they need to? Or are they trapped and are effectively a prisoner in the car? That's important to know. And it's important that passengers have that capability, that they're ultimately in control of their own life circumstances.
We saw that earlier this year with the, there was a Waymo. The guy got stuck in the parking lot.
Last week, we saw the Waymo drove into the shootout, right?
Oh, right.
Wouldn't you want to hop out before you got into that?
Right.
Or you, that's when you're like, I wish I was in my Cybertruck because it's bulletproof. Mm-hmm. All right. Can we save the next few for the following week?
Absolutely.
All right.
Just want people to remember, you're not going to get this from your local AV manufacturer.
Oh.
You know, we are the source of this information, and we're happy to share, and we're happy to get your feedback.
Yeah. And if you go to autosafety.org and you're like, where is this? It is listed as AV checklist right next to Lemon Laws on the top navigation of the site, autosafety.org. You go past Lemon Laws, go to AV checklist, and then you go over to donate. You click the hell out of that button. That's right. Let's do some recalls. Great. Rivian, first up, 34,824 vehicles. The 2022 to 2025 Rivian EDV. EDV, that's a weird one. Rivian has determined that on certain EDV vehicles, the driver's side seatbelt pretensioner may be damaged from repeated misuse, such as the driver sitting on the seatbelt while it's buckled underneath the driver. Oh, that, those people are just jackasses.
Yeah, I mean, part of you wants to say, well, you know, they kind of deserve whatever they get here because they're misusing the seatbelt. But I'm not sure if, you know, I don't know that that's the case with every one of these instances where the seatbelt has been damaged. And, you know, you just don't know. I don't even know if Rivian knows or if they're just trying to pass the buck onto their owners and try to blame it on bad behavior versus taking responsibility for not putting a seatbelt pretensioner together that can withstand this type of misuse. So essentially, you know, everybody's going to have to bring their car into Rivian. There's an over-the-air update that's part of this that's going to enable automatic detection of seatbelt misuse by the driver, which I like. And also, Rivian's going to inspect your seatbelt pretensioners and repair them if they have been damaged. So, despite the fact that Rivian is trying to shove the blame off onto bad guys here, it looks like they've, you know, come up with a pretty good plan. Looks like owners will be hearing about this and be able to take their cars in starting in the third week of January.
Excellent. Next up, Chrysler, 72,509 vehicles, the 2025-2026 Ram 2500 pickup, Ram 3500 pickup. They've been built with a 12-inch IPC containing sulfur that causes the customer, I don't want to be here anymore.
I mean, it's pretty easy. You know, the instrument panel goes out here. That's not only a non-compliance, it's also a safety defect. And for whatever reason, you know, this is traced back to bad software. And I think the recall is simply going to be, you know, either a reprogramming of that part or a potential replacement, I guess, depending on, you know, how bad the IPC is impacted. Who knows? That's a weird one where they're saying, you know, we can either replace the software or replace the hardware. You would think they would trace the problem to one or the other, but who knows? Looks like owners are going to hear about that later in January.
Volkswagen up next, 311 vehicles. I always like it when it's a small number like that. 2023-2024 Volkswagen ID4. That's why it's a small number. Individual battery cells and certain high voltage battery cell modules manufactured during a certain production period may contain misaligned electrodes. that can lead to a fire. That's why
we brought this one up, right? Because it's a park outside warning, and we like to let people know, do not park this in your garage. And get it fixed as soon as you possibly can. It looks like you're going to be able to do that at the end of January. So keep an eye out for that if you're one of the, you know, few people who own one of these vehicles.
I haven't seen one of those yet. Have you guys seen any of those on the road?
I think I've seen a couple, but nothing recently.
No.
Everybody I knew with a Volkswagen microbus way back when only used it to travel back and forth to California from Massachusetts. So these new electric guys don't really have the range to make that
useful.
Well, that and weed's legal in Massachusetts now. You don't have to do that run anymore.
No? Yeah, and this is the SUV version. It's not the mini, the cool
microbus
van. Right?
Oh, I thought it was.
These have been around for about 4 years now. I think the microbus was just released last year, but this car is, you know, they've had significant problems with these ID4s. I mean, I think this is the 12th recall on the 2023 model. So they're beating the Cybertruck.
Hey, you know how old I am? I am so old that when I was a kid, Coors was an exotic brand of beer that you could only get if you'd been west of the Mississippi River, which very few of my friends had been.
Please follow Fred's other podcast called When I Was a Youngin. You'll get such great anecdotes such as lawn darts. Should have kept them. Not everybody makes it.
Wasn't that a Saturday Night Live skit back in the day? Back in the olden days. That's it.
Maybe.
Well, the other problem that those had is that the phone cords didn't really stretch very long.
Last one. And this is the most interesting recall we've ever come across.
I thought it was pretty interesting. Yeah.
So this is Hyundai 483 vehicles, the 2023 to 2026 Genesis G90. And so what's going on is the car's HDA, the highway driving assist feature. It's not quite their version of like Blue Cruise, Super Cruise, but similar. Anyway, that thing, it relies on radar sensors placed around the car, but in cars painted Saville silver, the aluminum content of that shade can cause the front corner radar signals to reflect off the paint itself. And when it does, the system believes it's detecting an object in the opposing lane and it applies the brakes.
That's weird.
It's like it's own stealth
lighting itself. Yeah.
It's its own stealth paint job.
It's really interesting that you know, there's this one color that does it, presumably because of the aluminum content. You know, I wonder what this color or, you know, that aluminum content in there does to other vehicles' radar that are trying to detect, you know, the Genesis vehicle. So that's something that we've never come across before. And certainly something I think that, you know, sensor manufacturers and automakers need to look at, you know, the aluminum content and paint or other metals that might impact the sensing and detection capabilities of these vehicles.
Is it just where those radar sensors are? Like if they move them back an inch or forward an inch, maybe the problem doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it's probably like a lot like chaff, which they dropped out of bombers. So when the, you know, that's a problem for the near term or near range reflection off the paint, but it's not a problem for detection by other vehicles because it just appears as a maybe slightly fuzzier cloud than it would have otherwise. So that's my guess.
Also, my guess is what's happening here is the 12-year-olds in the paint shop at Hyundai maybe aren't applying things as well as they should.
That's a possibility.
They added too much aluminum to the paint.
Kids are like, we miss lead and school and child labor laws. Ah! All right. That was a show. Thanks, listeners.
Great segue. Great segue, Anthony.
Yeah. We'll be back again next week, and we've recorded on a Tuesday again next week. So, hey, if something exciting happens on Wednesday, we'll have missed it in the show, but we'll follow it up the following week. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.